Welcome to Responding to ACEs, Resources for Resilience, a continuing medical education podcast series brought to you by the College of the Arts and Media and the College of Medicine at Central Michigan University. Adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, are more prevalent than we think and affect people across all backgrounds. There is mounting evidence that childhood trauma and stress have long-term effects on mental and physical health. The more ACEs a person experiences, the greater the risk of adverse chronic health conditions in adulthood. But there is hope for healing. In this CME podcast series, we will provide you with knowledge, tools, and resources to build a collaborative care approach to addressing ACEs. In this third module of Responding to ACEs, Resources for Resilience, we will discuss what healthcare providers can do to help patients with ACEs get the help they need beyond a physical medical diagnosis and treatment. In the first module in the series, you learned what adverse childhood experiences are and their effect on children and adults, but also the disturbing link between ACEs and chronic diseases in adults. In the second module, the physiological effects of ACEs were described in detail. Childhood trauma and stress can actually change gene expression, and these epigenetic changes can actually be passed down from generation to generation. These effects are often associated with dysregulation and behavior issues in children and adults. We know that adverse childhood experiences can leave lasting detrimental effects, but let's look at how healthcare providers can address the impact of developmental trauma. The Michigan Association of Health Plans Foundation created the Michigan ACE Initiative. Part of this initiative is the Master Trainer Program. Dr. Lourdes Morales is a general pediatrician and pediatric hospitalist in Saginaw, who also teaches pediatrics at Central Michigan University's College of Medicine. Dr. Morales shares how she learned about ACEs and connected with the Michigan ACE Initiative Master Trainer Program.
The adverse childhood experiences, I first learned about them while I was working here at CMU probably 3 years ago when I went to the Resilience movie for their first viewing. And I was asked by one of our child psychiatrists to be part of the panel after movie, so that was my first introduction to it. And after that, then I became more involved, and then eventually I became a master trainer for ACEs. It was like opening a new chapter in my career. I went into pediatrics because I liked more the disease process in children and taking care of the sick child, but more physical illness, not so much mental illness. And as I grow in my career, I realized that I really need to pay attention to the development and mental health as well. So that's really what attracted me to the training, that it really gave me that opportunity to learn about being a pediatrician, that it's not just about physical, but mental health as well. ACEs will affect the neurodevelopment of a child. So it is important because now we know that you can inherit some of that damage. It gets passed on. As a parent, I experience it. You might be aware of it and you don't want to pass it on to your child, as you don't want to mimic the same behaviors or the same experiences, but it's already in your genes. So the effects that it had on your health are going to be inherited. So it's important to be aware of that so that we can do things to prevent the future risk that those bad genes that you inherited kind of flourish. As a pediatric hospitalist, once I became familiar and knowledgeable about ACEs and how prevalent, fortunately, they are, it really changed how I approach a family when I first meet a child in the hospital. As I teach the medical students to take a history, it's not only about knowing the importance of the abdominal pain or the cough that the patient has had or the fever, but as we move on, we also need to know the social history of this family and of this child. And what that means in medicine is we need to know, where is the child living? Who cares for the child? Is there enough money in the family even to afford the medications? Is there a transportation issue? Does the family understand the illness that the patient is experiencing? I began to emphasize that aspect of taking a history more with medical students, so they were able to identify certain social components that could determine the health outcome for that child.
In the hospital setting, Dr. Morales treats what some may view as difficult patients, But Dr. Morales would like us to change our mindset on how we view patients affected by ACEs.
There are different ways that we start suspecting the presence of ACEs. Usually the easiest one to recognize, I would say, is usually a teenage patient that comes from a detention facility. Troubled teenagers are angry. It's hard to get a conversation going. When you're trying to ask questions, they act older, but they also act disinterested. They just don't want to talk to you. So just establishing that rapport, trying to find something that can connect you with them. You have to find something in common and kind of go from there. Just not asking only alone about, tell me about your fever, your headache, but tell me about your best friend and tell me something about you. And then kind of going backwards, getting that social history first and then getting the other information later. There is this culture, not only among the medical students, but also the hospital staff in general. They almost label that patient or that child as it was like your fault or you don't belong to the society. And then just trying to change that culture and say it wasn't their fault. They just didn't know better. And they are just a result of ACEs. And introducing that, and as I interact with the patient, showing compassion and letting the patient know that all the things that happened to you in the past, you don't need to identify yourself with that. Just making them aware as the same time that I make the students and the staff aware of the importance of knowing about ACEs, because it changes our culture and how we view the patient and really our interaction. It's important to us to recognize it so that we can humanize the patient, that we don't punish the patient because of the prejudices that we have. I think we should be treating every child the same. And what I mean by that, even those that have a high ACE score, just the same as a child that hasn't experienced any ACEs. And that's where I find barrier or problem, mainly because we, as a society, we already have, especially for teenagers that come from the foster care system or they come from a detention center, we already have this prejudice of they are just sociopath or this is who they are and that's it. So I want to change that conscious. I want to teach the staff and the medical students and the physicians in training that I work with that they are just a product of their environment, that they were raised and all these different experiences that unfortunately they had to witness during their upbringing that got them there. As soon as I acknowledge who they are and I'm just kind to them, I see a difference. In the beginning, they're going to be upset, just like they are so upset about the world. But once I acknowledge what they have been going through, and I just kind of love them, we establish a good relationship. Who notices that the most is actually my team of learners. I see that the residents start interacting differently, and they even mention how much they have learned from those interactions. Just kind of seeing the patient as a whole and not just punishing the patient for what they have been through.
Respect and kindness help disarm a defensive patient, and a social history will help you understand some of the barriers to that patient's good health. In the hospital, Dr. Morales admits it's a little easier to connect patients to the resources they require.
When we're in a hospital setting and I have medical students who do social screening or ask about the social environment, if the answer is I don't have enough food or I don't have money, if it's money that we need to pay for a medication, in the hospital there are services already in place to give them a voucher for money so that they can go home already with the medication, for example. If they have no transportation and then we need them to go to the doctor for follow-up or to travel to see a specialist, then we work with insurance because insurance will provide taxi services. And maybe the patients might not know that. So we hook them with the system and with the resources that are out there that they just don't know that they exist. The hospital has social workers and discharge planners that are available to connect the patient with all the different resources. It's very tough for a pediatrician that is in private practice because you wouldn't have the staff that works with you that can help you connect. At CMU, for example, we have a social worker through the health department here, and that is very helpful. And so it's tough if you're a solo pediatrician. The parents themselves have literacy and numeracy issues, and so on cognitive disabilities or learning disorders, so it's hard for them to navigate the system. We need someone else that can help the patient be able to integrate themselves back to the society just because they need help. They need someone that guides them. It's very hard to do it on your own. if I have a patient, even in the hospital setting, I identify that the family is at risk for ACEs or the parents have experienced some degree of ACEs too, then I shift my education to the parents, try to enhance some parenting skills and teach them about neurodevelopment and what can they do to stimulate the little brain and go from there. We know that it's going to affect the neurodevelopment of a child, so we need to do something to prevent it or to enhance that stimulation. I do encourage a lot of parenting classes to our parents when I identify that the parents are the ones going through it and have an infant. How can I enhance better parenting skills? There are different classes that they can take. I try to connect them with a church group or a community. Have that sense of community. Even if you are not very religious, just going back to a church, that you get that love, that welcoming, and I think that's very important. And I try to incorporate that as one of my advice for that family, to try to find a community.
One way to find out about ACEs in patients is to use the questionnaires developed by Drs. Vincent Folletti and Robert Anda in the first ACEs study, published in 1998 in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. These questionnaires are not copyrighted and available on the CDC website. Simpler versions that focus only on the 10 ACEs are available through a simple internet search. Dr. Kyle Rutledge is a child and adolescent psychiatry resident fellow in CMU's College of Medicine and also has a PhD in human development. Dr. Rutledge explains how to use these types of questionnaires in private practice.
The CDC has been talking about increasing screening, and the American Academy of Pediatrics also put out a nice publication that talks about how to implement it into the clinics, which I think is a big task in and of itself. So that's one kind of broad blanket way of dealing with it, is bringing the screening forms out there, finding a way to integrate it into your day-to-day assessments of patients, just like you would take vitals for them. And then paying attention to the patients who have high numbers of ACEs, or even one or two ACEs are enough to have significant downstream effects with the body, as well as the mind and the family unit. So the recommendation that the American Academy of Pediatrics was to flag those particular patients and make sure you're following up on that. The screening and the following up is the first step. But then, of course, the question is, now what do we do? Because that's where all the literature out there just seems to conveniently hit the conclusion of, well, and that's what we do. We just screen for it. But if we're able to modify the ongoing sorts of stressors and environmental factors that are contributing, then we can actually see some degree of reversal of some of these things. And some of the studies that were done early on with the biochemical changes and the epigenetic changes, that it is reversible even at the molecular level. Due to ethical and logistical reasons, they can't repeat that. We also can see with improving just the social groups that individuals are in, you're going to have some improvement. So the question still being, what can physicians do about it after screening for it and finding it? There aren't real blanket statewide or nationwide sorts of programs that people will automatically fit into. But if you think about the patient in front of you who has one or two ACEs and compare them to another person with one or two ACEs, they're going to be completely different. So it's actually illogical to assume that you're going to have one cookie cutter solution for both of them. So what it actually comes down to is a nice creative solution from the practitioner that we don't think that we have the capability of doing. We assume that we need a kind of an outlying outside structure, but I think just as human beings, we can think about exactly what they need, give them that extra 60 to 90 seconds of time to figure out exactly what it is most pressing for them now, and then knowing that you're going to follow up with them 6 months down the line, 12 months down the line. Putting that in your notes is something that you're working towards. Coming up with a creative and collaborative solution for the patient and actually just putting a little bit of effort into it to change the trajectory is actually going to be a lot more impactful than you would automatically assume.
Just as Dr. Morales suggested, getting in the habit of taking a social history for every child patient, the CDC recommends screening for ACEs in every patient.
ACEs can be hidden, so the recommendation is that everyone gets screened. across the board, not only those with mental illness, not only those with chronic illness, but as part of the kind of walking through the door, getting to know the patient, it seems the recommendation is generally to have that sort of questionnaire. And it only takes a minute to fill out. There are some elements of the ACEs questionnaire that can change over time, but for the most part, especially when you're seeing an adult, because we can talk about ACEs in childhood, the child patient, or in adulthood looking back, they don't change that much. So you could, in theory, just screen them once. If they have a zero, then move on. You don't have to worry about it. In the ones that do have high numbers, even one or two or six or seven, by following up, it would be considering that as a biological risk factor, just like something like smoking is. So in the same mentality that you have to follow up with a smoking patient and to say, are you still smoking? Are you willing to change? Having that conversation in the same way you talk about, okay, how's your home environment or whatever that specific stressor was, whether it was an adult in the house who is abusive or out getting alcohol treatment or someone who's incarcerated, things like that. Since we can't change those factors, but we can change how the person responds to it and the other sort of resources they reach out to, following up on how they are and pursuing those or addressing it themselves and their own comfort level with those sorts of things. A lot of times they are silent, so which is why you want to ask everyone. It's so ingrained in them, they might just not automatically bring it up during their visit with you. So it's something to ask about, and then you kind of get this really, really important information about the patient.
After you pinpoint a patient's ACE score, one physician or doctor's office alone will not be able to fix everything. You will need help connecting a patient to resources. But never underestimate the power of just listening and showing that you care.
The CDC is all about building a support network for these particular patients, and that is going to include a collaborative care model. Because you aren't going to be able to physically go out and solve those things, it would be having that collaborative treatment planning and getting them in connection with any resources that might be available to them. This might require getting to know the family dynamic a little bit better and their limitations. Perhaps there are financial resources in the community or from the government that they would qualify for that they aren't aware of that would help some of these things. And also if there's a deficit in sort of understanding of where the parents are coming from, since they're being affected very strongly by the deficiencies at home as well. If you're the gatekeeper and the team leader, then it's getting them in contact with all of those people, giving them that sense of hope and pointing them in the direction of anyone who can help with their specific sorts of issues. That might be the most someone has cared about that person all day. Even those ones who are hard to engage with, making that effort to really get them to open up and talk about these things is enough to make them feel heard and feel like someone cares enough to stop what they're doing, give them their full attention, and really see how they can help. Even if there isn't an automatic solution, sometimes the person is going to leave feeling uplifted just because someone listened to them and they felt like they had a nice human connection for once in their day.
Dr. Cheryl Geisthart is a professor of childhood development and family studies who focuses on trauma, stress, coping, and resilience in children and families. Dr. Geisthart explains the collaborative care model, but also the importance of connecting with patients and families.
I think it's critically important that we work across disciplines, working with mental health, behavioral health, working with educators, developing those relationships. No one has to do it alone. So when you have a child or a family that you're working with and you start to identify issues, you know, we can't expect, and we don't expect physicians to be able to handle all of that on their own, but being familiar with community resources, working with them, and not just simply referring, but actually building those relationships so we can communicate. The best programs have brought different people with different disciplines together to be able to support children. So I think physicians are in a great place often to identify problems, especially if they can build those relationships with those families where they feel safe and secure. I also think it's really important that physicians understand that link between physical and mental health. And also, I'm going to defend parents here for a moment, because one of the biggest challenges I've seen in my history of work is that kids are having problems, and sometimes they are family-related problems. They're not always. Those original ACEs were primarily family-based problems, but we know from the research there's a whole lot of other problems, bullying, school violence, neighborhood violence, dealing with housing insecurity, not enough food, all of those things also, which are outside the family, are contributing factors. We're a very individualistic society. So when children are having problems, the very first people that tend to get blamed are the parents. Believe me, I've worked with some very challenging parents, and I understand that can be difficult. But when we understand that intergenerational transmission, and we understand that many of these parents have their own stuff that they haven't dealt with, or that it's been biologically embedded to them, so now they're hyperreactive, they don't know how to parent in an effective way because they didn't experience that themselves, their bodies are themselves on that fight-flight response. It's really easy to get very judgy of parents. And so one of the best ways we can support children is by working with parents and respecting parents and supporting them and empowering them. T. Barry Brazelton, world-renowned pediatrician, he wrote some popular press, a lot of parenting books. One of the things he's most known for is touch points. And that training is really good at helping people put themselves in the position of the parents. And how do you show respect for those parents? And what assumptions, if you walk into that room as a medical provider, would be helpful in developing that relationship? So yes, it's easy to be frustrated when parents aren't doing things you think they should be doing. But if you walk in there and assume that parents love and care for their children, and they're doing their best. Many parents who are struggling recognize that they're struggling and they feel incompetent. And so it really focuses on building relationships with parents and helping them to feel respected as experts on their children, as competent, even if they've had a lot of stress in their lives. And to watch him and work, and you can Google Brazelton and watch some clips of him working with parents. He's just a very humble physician who could just connect with families in ways that not all medical providers have been trained to do. And I think some of it is part of personality, but a lot of it can be trained. Training such as those help medical providers understand how they could use what we are now referring to as a more trauma-informed approach.
If you would like more information on touchpoints, go to brazeltontouchpoints.org. But again, connecting patients to resources will take time and effort, plus the knowledge of the resources available in your community.
The American Academy of Pediatrics put out a policy statement for pediatricians' roles in toxic stress, and there's multiple components to it. One would be identifying it. Two would be connecting with community resources and building those networks. Three would be more the policy level. First of all, physicians and other medical providers need the time to do this stuff, to get to know their patients and what their challenges are so that they can figure out what the best resources are going to be. So it's not that the medical providers themselves have to provide those mental health or behavioral health services, for example, or housing support. But if they're connected with the community and they know what resources are available and what each agency does rather than that silo thing, they can help connect. Some of the most creative and best programs that have emerged, and we have some of them here in Michigan, are ones that really bring the services to the families that are really challenged, especially for lower income families. You know, saying you need to go see a child psychiatrist in many cases not going to happen. How are you going to get there? How are you going to figure out how that's going to get paid for? How are you going to do all the things you need to do? So in some places have started to bring those services to the schools. And these are relatively new and there's not a lot of them yet. Let me be real clear about that. But outside of just having a school social worker, they'll have those services available on site at the school. And they collaborate with the medical professional. For children, for example, that do need medication because it's progressed far enough that they do, at least for a while, need some support for anxiety or depression or behavior issues, they can collaborate with the teachers, they can collaborate with the on-site medical professionals or behavioral health specialists to help children reach their fullest potential and become resilient.
Dr. Geishart, like Dr. Morales, is a Michigan ACE Initiative Master Trainer.
The Michigan ACE Initiative is phenomenal. It's about first educating people, and not just physicians, not just medical providers, but our general society. It's about connecting as communities. Their focus largely is on when you give people the knowledge and you have people work together in their communities, they can solve their own problems, in essence, in many ways. It's not quite that simple. Obviously, we need resources, et cetera. When we share these really cool projects that are happening throughout Michigan, then we learn about these schools that are incorporating on-site care and how that's going for them, or who have learned to take more of a trauma-informed approach and rather than a punitive approach in their classrooms. We're still dealing with discipline, but we're doing it in a very different way. And they're having success. When we share those out to others, others, it gives others ideas and what you can make happen in your own community. So in Michigan, I want to be optimistic and say we're a little ahead of the curve in terms of bringing these issues forward. Certainly there are other states who've been doing it for a while, but collaboration is key. Like, we just need to talk. We need to talk with each other as professionals. We need to talk with community members. One of the coolest things for me going through the ACE Master Training was being in the room with all these master trainers-to-be and it being a very diverse group of professionals. We had medical professionals from pediatricians, family practice. We had teachers. We had social workers. We had law enforcement. We had higher ed. We had K-12 folks. And really working together is how we're going to best solve these problems within our communities as well. Working with the people and the strengths in our communities as well as the services in our communities.
To find out more about the Michigan ACE Initiative, go to miace.org. Other good sources to help you help your patients with ACEs can be found on the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services website and the Michigan Health and Improvement Alliance, or MHIA, website. In this module, we learned healthcare providers need to find out about community resources, screen for ACEs, and get a social history from patients. Take time to listen to what happened to patients, then connect patients to resources. Do you have time to do all of this? This is a tall order, and healthcare providers will need assistance to do it. But these actions will help get people on the path to resilience. In the next module in Responding to ACEs, Resources for Resilience, you will hear about successful psychological treatments helping children and families deal with childhood trauma and toxic stress. This has been a production of the College of the Arts and Media and the College of Medicine at Central Michigan University.